This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I work with entrepreneurs and go-getters to optimize the health and performance of these world-changing innovators, people kind of like you. Before we jump into today's podcast, I want to thank our sponsor, Legacy. Legacy is an online membership community that provides monthly accountability coaching with a personal health coach and access to lifestyle products at discounts not available to the general public. The neuroscience that connects the benefits of being accountable to another human being and our capacity to stick to goals and commitments is profound. We are sculpted by our commitment and discipline to our daily decisions. Legacy helps that happen. Legacy memberships start at just $22 per month. To learn more, visit legacymemberships.com. With us today is Dr. Mark Bubbs, and we are talking about the ancestral or paleo lifestyle and the wisdom that it can play in the context of our modern world. Dr. Bubbs is a board-certified naturopathic doctor, author, speaker, sports nutrition lead for the Canadian men's national basketball team, and a strength coach. He works with athletes and active people and those striving to improve their health for over a decade. He is passionate that diet, exercise, and lifestyle are the most powerful tools for improving your overall health, and he is the author of the Paleo Project, the 21st Century Guide to Looking Leaner, Getting Stronger, and Living Longer. Dr. Bubbs sees patients in downtown Toronto, and we had a really great conversation today. We talked about misconceptions related to cholesterol and the cultural and health implications that fear-mongering has played in terms of our health now. We talk about jet lag and circadian rhythm and some of the things that you can do to help get over jet lag faster. It is awesome. And we look at the things that we're doing on a daily basis that are really driving us towards an epidemic of anxiety and depression. And Mark threw down the stat that the World Health Organization is predicting that in another 20 years, 30% of the population could be suffering from anxiety or depression, and we are determined to stop it. It was a great interview, and it was my pleasure and is my pleasure to welcome him to the podcast. Here he is, Dr. Mark Bubbs. Mark, it is so great to have you on the podcast.
Awesome. Thanks, Dr. Meg. Great to be here.
Yeah, I know. We had the chance to do this a few weeks ago on your podcast, and now the tables are turning. And I had so many things that I wanted to ask you that day and realized it's totally inappropriate to interrogate the host. So I'm glad I get this opportunity to follow up.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. And we got some phenomenal feedback from your episode. So yeah, it was really great.
Yeah, it was great. It was so much fun. So you're a naturopathic doctor, and you have really evolved to a place where your niche and expertise is in ancestral medicine. Can you explain a little bit about what that is, how that maybe differs from paleo, which is another term that gets thrown around, and how you got to this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think like a lot of things, it sort of finds you or stumbles upon you more than you go to seek it out. So thinking about it, there's probably two main episodes of my life that kind of brought me to this area. One of them was actually after university, after doing my undergrad and wanting to get into medicine, but not really figuring out which kind of branch I wanted to get into. I took some time off and went to the UK and London and worked as a personal trainer, and was blown away at how with just food and exercise and, you know, telling people to get some more sleep, etc., we could really radically change people's outcomes in terms of, you know, the blood labs they were getting and the results they were getting with their doctors. So that kind of put that first little seed in my mind around this idea of, you know, food and movement and everything else. And I think the second piece was after getting out of naturopathic school, I got the chance to travel down to the Ancestral Health Symposium down in Berkeley in, you know, 13, 14 perhaps, and just a really great group of people who were all from various, a really wide variety, varied background, physiologists, biochemists, doctors, anthropologists, and speaking on this notion of going back and using this evolutionary lens to just try to answer and solve a lot of the questions, whether it's health related or otherwise.
I feel like it's, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, I feel like almost with the ancestral or paleo movement, people were pulled there because of science, as opposed to some other ways of eating that are maybe more emotionally or socially driven. Is that observation accurate, or am I just totally making stuff up here?
No, I feel like that's pretty accurate. And I think, you know, as anything becomes more popular, I think the term paleo has sort of become a little bit of a caricature. And I think that's where, you know, this term ancestral is becoming more popular now and known. And the two have always been sort of well aligned. But that's definitely where you get some tremendous amount of research and just real deep thinkers trying to solve problems again across the board, not just health, with this evolutionary lens. So it's pretty cool.
And have you always eaten this way or lived this way, I guess?
I have not always eaten this way. I mean, going back to, you know, the high school, early university days, I'm going to date myself here. It was almost like the start of the internet. You know, this was before we had all this wonderful information. And so it's funny because a lot of people in the same era who struggled like I did with this sort of chronically getting sick or mucus or discomfort from the foods that I was eating, we would go, you know, going to the vegan route was kind of the thing to do. That was the, you know, take all the dairy out and you got better. I mean, I got a lot better. The mucus and the congestion and all these things improved. But then, you know, I sort of hit, you know, didn't take me all the way there. And this is another one of those perfect situations where, not by any choice of my own, after university, I decided to do some traveling. I was living in, traveling through Central America for a year. And of course, you know, being a vegan in Central America is not very easy. So I got back to eating some meat. And that's when, again, getting back to almost like 3 square meals a day and eating a very sort of somewhat plain or not so varied diet. And all of a sudden I started feeling really good. And a lot of things that had been symptoms that had been plaguing me for years started to go away. So this is where, again, that idea of just the food that I was eating really impacting my health.
Right. And so what are some of the tenets of ancestral medicine? And I picked the word tenets, not rules, because I feel like rules just people just shut off in terms of adopting something new. But like, what are the basics? What do we need to know if we're like, I kind of want to try this out?
I think if we really want to simplify it, just thinking of it as coming at everything from an evolutionary lens. So if we use an example, let's say cholesterol. So for the last 30 years, we've had this war on cholesterol. We're worried about high cholesterol. And the medical community, we've managed to scare most people off of eating things that have cholesterol in them. And then you start to ask yourself, well, wait a minute. If we go back through evolution, you know, 70% of cholesterol production is made internally in our own bodies. So over the course of these hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, we never lost that ability. Our bodies held on to the capacity to produce cholesterol at 70% rate, which is enormous. And of course, when you look through the biochemistry and physiology, you realize that, you know, all our hormones are made of cholesterol. Cellular membranes need cholesterol to function. So to be alive, if we didn't have cholesterol, we wouldn't survive. And so this obviously tells us that it must be important. It must do a lot of really key things in the body, because if we flip that a little bit and go back far enough, we used to produce vitamin C in our bodies, just like most mammals on the planet. But we lost that ability a long, long time ago because we could walk around and forage and eat berries and leafy greens and all sorts of stuff. So I think that really helps to set the tone on a lot of discussions, because it's amazing how, especially for the average person or the busy person or the entrepreneur who's trying to be healthy, but they're getting a lot of information today on all sorts of stuff. It's difficult to navigate on like what is right and what is wrong, because we're sort of overwhelmed or overloaded a little bit with information now.
Right. So it's like, it's real food.
Yeah. I mean, there you go. You want to make it really simple. Eat real food. Whatever your grandparents could eat, go for it.
You heard it here first, people.
It's an interesting concept, but it's amazing how this is finally taking root in the sort of the mainstream medicine, which is mind-boggling. And if you went back far enough before the Industrial Revolution, then this would have been, you know, diet was more of an active component of most physicians' toolbox.
Right, right. I know. And I had a patient this week and I said that to them. They're like, what am I doing diet-wise? And I said, you're eating real food. And they looked at me with this puzzled look and they were like, Can you explain what that might be in a little bit more detail for me? And like I was trying so hard to just hold it together, because we shouldn't have to ask that, right? But the reality is I think that we have. And so many of, you know, certainly my patients, and I'm sure yours, they're busy people, right? They're out doing really cool stuff. And so they're traveling, they're on the go, they are. Do you have suggestions in terms of how to continue to adhere to the ancestral lifestyle for people who aren't necessarily like 9-to-5ers and have complete control over their schedule, they're in airports? Like, what kind of tips do you have in that respect?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways you could do this in terms of travel. I mean, for busy people, again, this idea, just getting back to three square meals. I've written a couple of recent blog articles, one for Breaking Muscle, about this norm that we've gotten into, this idea of consuming five or six meals, which is supposed to increase our metabolism to help us lose weight. And if you ask people, that's why they do it. But when you look at the research and a recent meta-analysis, like the grouping of all these most impactful studies, only one out of 20 showed any benefit. So once you remove that one, the researchers concluded there's no benefit to increasing metabolism or to weight loss when we increase this meal frequency. So what we tend to find in sort of a real life setting is that we just snack on stuff and it's easier to get into this caloric excess. And that's why maybe we're kind of stuck into whether it's, trying to lose weight or even just being mentally sharp, because your blood sugars are just riding this high and low through the day. So getting back to three square meals is great. If you're traveling, airport snacks, for me, again, it can be a gas station, pharmacy, airport, nuts and jerky, which might sound a little intense for some people, but the newer forms of jerky, it's not like the truck driver jerky you're perhaps thinking of in your mind, but that's kind of a really easy one, because you're going to get real clean protein and a great sources of fats, so that can be a really good one. And then when I recently was just in Montreal for a conference over the weekend, and this might be, maybe a step more than some people are initially willing to go, but it is very extremely nutrient dense, is, for breakfast, a can of sardines, and again, just some mixed nuts. And the really funny part is when you go to, let's say, a convenience store and you look at the health food section, and there's all these wonderful protein bars for $5 or $6, the can of sardines is $2 and is maybe like 10 to 50 to 100 fold times better for you than the $5 protein bar. And that's not to say that there's not a time and a place, but again, it gets back to this idea of just trying to find more real food. But those are some nice options. And then even not eating, like if you're going to travel, depending, and there's some cool strategies for helping to offset jet lag and reset, circadian rhythms, and meal timing can be a really key one there. So if you're traveling somewhere and landing and you're adjusting to a new time zone, you can actually not have dinner, right? Just maybe check in, go for a nice hot sauna or hot tub, and then have that breakfast early the next morning. That's going to be a great way for you to sort of reset that circadian pattern and get you into the new time zone. So that can be a strategy as well for some people.
Yeah, I really like that, because I think that we get really caught up in the diet piece, right? And I think you and I have had conversations about this before. It's an ancestral lifestyle. And I think you had an article recently on your blog where you talked about that. You were talking about the secrets to longevity and sort of the ancestral take on that. What is that secret that the ancestral lifestyle holds?
Well, yeah, there's quite a few, and it's going to actually be a little series on my blog, because there's so many. But it's amazing. The study came out a couple of years ago, and we see in all these modern day hunter gatherer tribes. So whether it's in South America or Africa or parts of Australia, getting up with the morning sun. So we always think of the sun as vitamin D, but especially if you live in a winter climate like we do here in Toronto, where it's cold and dark in the wintertime, getting exposure to outdoor light is, again, this massive stimulus to setting our circadian rhythm, which, again, if you're not familiar with that term, it's just that natural daily production of hormones. And in fact, each cell of our body runs on these little 24-hour clocks. So it's a phenomenal way to do that. And I've actually been using a light box therapy. When you get up at 5:30 or 6 and it's really dark out, doesn't become light until 7:38, then it's a great way, 10 or 15 minutes while you're having your coffee or while you're checking your emails, to serve as a proxy for sun. And that's one of the things they found amongst the hunter-gatherers, was actually rising with the sun. They also do all their activity in the AM, which is really beneficial. So they are moving around, which is a key part. Again, we tend to be, quite sedentary. The last couple pieces too, I'll just mention, that are pretty noteworthy. They're early to bed, right? So they get to bed definitely before midnight. And when it's winter time, they get to bed even an hour or an hour and a half earlier. And if you think about, the dog days of December and January, when the days are at their shortest, we tend to be our most busy, right? We're doing more, we've got more social commitments, we've got more holiday commitments. So that can be a big drain on a lot of systems. And I'm gonna keep going here. There's another one that's really nice, which is basically, if you've ever been camping, Have you trying to eat once the sun goes down is really challenging.
I thought you were going to say, have you ever been camping?
Like trying to get that food in. So you make sure that you eat before the sun goes down, right?
Right.
So another piece of this is this idea of eating earlier and not eating too late, which is, again, another great resetter of these circadian patterns. So all these things that, again, you would do if you were just naturally outside more, or 100 years ago or plus, you know, our great grandparents would have just been doing this as a result of how they lived. And that's a bit more in sync with how we've evolved. And it does have a lot of benefits. And the key part is you don't have to jump in and do all of these things. But if you start realizing that some areas, like if you are someone who gets up a lot very early in the morning, then there's some things that you can do. There's some cool hacks that you can do to kind of offset that and help you to just to feel sharp and focused and ready to attack the day.
Yeah. And, you know, as you're saying this, I want to point out to people who are listening that you have two small children and you're married and you have a busy lifestyle. So, you know, I think it's easy for a lot of people to go, oh, yeah, well, you know, Dr. Bugs can eat at 5 o'clock, but I've got kids and activities and all of these other things. How do you incorporate this lifestyle into the how do you integrate the ancestral lifestyle into the busyness of you as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a struggle for everyone in terms of finding enough hours in the day. And so I think, you know, this is where just eating the right stuff and moving a little bit can help you to be really productive. So rather than thinking of, we always tend to think of changing our diet or exercising as this quest to improve body composition or lose weight, but really we just want to make people feel sharp and be really vital so they can excel in their job or their home life or whatever it is. And, you know, I think, again, wintertime, the light box is a great one. I really cordon off parts of my day. So just going longer stretches, I'll have days where I do some intermittent fasting. So it'll just be, you know, coffee in the morning and then just getting a lot of stuff done for that 4 hour, 5 hour block. And at least then you feel like you've ticked a lot of things off of your list before getting into the afternoon. So, you know, there's a lot of different strategies that people can use. I think it's always really good to come back to really identifying for yourself what are the big roadblocks, like what are those one or two things that are really holding me back the most to feeling my best or being more productive in my work. And then you can really strategize, you know, the best diet or even workout, because you don't have to put lots of hours into working out. It can be very, very, very time efficient, and all of a sudden you'll feel better, think better with minimal sort of effort, which is kind of what we're after.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'd encourage people too, when you're talking about this concept of like assessing what your roadblocks are. I was working with someone yesterday and she articulated, she's like, you know, my biggest roadblock is that my house is a mess and there's clutter and it feels like it's cluttering my life. And so, you know, I think we get really focused on the things you eat and how much you move and don't sit down and all of these instructions. But it also means addressing those things in your life that are keeping you from engaging in those types of activities.
For sure. And it's always, you know, start small. I think a lot of times, especially if you're naturally a type A or naturally a go-getter, it's always this idea of like trying to run through the brick wall rather than just taking the door that's next to the brick wall. Like sometimes the easier route, the more efficient route is going to get you there much quicker, much more efficiently. So, you know, getting back to smaller exercise routines, take 5 minutes in the morning, take 10 minutes in the morning, these types of things. I mean, if you've ever set a timer for 3 minutes and just done as many burpees as you can, there's no way you want to go any more than 3 minutes. You know, you're ready to, you're ready to sit down and eat breakfast because it's very, very intense. And you realize that you could be really efficient with some of the things that we're doing, especially if you find that you've reached a plateau. If you feel like you've reached a plateau, the most common thing I see in clinical practice is people will just add more days of running the same intensity, more spin classes, more of the same, in an attempt to get a different response, and you don't get further benefit, and it's a major, major drain, which will then lead to all sorts of dominoes going down in the wrong direction in terms of your productivity and health and everything else.
Right. It's such a good point. And I think so many of these people can take that logic and apply it to other areas of their life or their leadership. But it's funny when you put it in the context of health, it's an area that people really struggle with. You know, Mark, you mentioned that occasionally you engage in intermittent fasting to remain sharp and focused. And this is something that people ask me about all the time. Can you talk a little bit about what intermittent fasting is all about and how it affects brain and brain clarity?
For sure. Yeah. I think if we go back to this ancestral or evolutionary viewpoint, you think to yourself, okay, well, we used to be walking around in the forest or the jungle and, you know, there were no Starbucks or Tim Hortons around. So we had to look for our food, and at certain times of year, we'd be looking for a long time. So weeks and weeks would go by, we wouldn't be eating anything. And we didn't, you know, fall over on the sidewalk or on the ground and collapse in a heap like sometimes we think here if we don't eat every 3 hours. We made it through. So how is this possible? Well, you know, it's called basically a state of ketosis when you really restrict carbohydrate intake. And of course, back then it's because there was, you know, looking for food. And your body shifts into this different metabolic gear. So it's much better at burning body fat as a fuel source. And you actually start producing ketone bodies, which is, you know, another alternative fuel source, which is a great source of ATP, which is energy for the body and for the brain. And, you know, eventually we would have found something lying on the floor there, like an apple with some, you know, that had gone off a little bit. And of course, you wouldn't have walked past it going, well, that one's not ripe enough, or I don't think I'll eat that one. I'll go another 3 weeks and wait for the next one. You know, we would have eaten it, which is where you get these naturally fermented things as well. So that's kind of the backstory. And we realized, well, having these periods of restricting food intake is a great way to improve a lot of health parameters. And of course, today, you know, if you eat first thing in the morning and then you have a snack right before bed, we're almost eating for 18, 19 hours of the day and not eating for only 6 or 6.5. So effectively with intermittent fasting, we're shrinking the eating window and expanding the non-eating window. And it has some nice benefits for mental clarity, has some great benefits for weight loss and various health conditions like dyslipidemias and blood sugar dysfunction. And the most common way is really to kind of delay breakfast until later, like 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. Or even noon. And then, you know, eating your last meal about 8 hours later. So if you had your breakfast at 10, your last meal would be 6. And then outside of those windows, you're not allowed to eat. So I think so for some people, having that real clear cut definition of when they can and can't can be quite helpful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And how's the best way to measure if you're in ketosis?
Well, if you want to go down, like, you know, I encourage people, if they're starting out with this, to probably even start with a low carb approach or with an intermittent fasting approach and then go deeper into the ketogenic approach, because it's a very restricted carbohydrate diet, which has tremendous benefit. But if you're not so metabolically flexible, if your body struggles from going from burning the carbs that you're consuming to burning the body fat on your body, then it can be, you know, you can hit some blood sugar lows that are, you know, leave your colleagues and coworkers not wanting to hang around with you, or, you know, or you looking for a nap under your desk or something. So if you did want to go down that route, once you're there, then you can, a low fidelity test would be to use something like a urine dipstick to just see if you see ketones. Once you find that that's pretty regular, a higher fidelity approach would be to use, you know, blood meter analysis. So just, you know, you prick your finger, you put a blood spot onto the little stick, and then the meter will tell you how many millimoles of ketones you have in the bloodstream. So that'll be a really effective way to let you know you're sort of locked into this ketosis area. And that'll be a confirmation that your body is effectively burning fats very well as a fuel source. And of course, a lot of people get tremendous brain benefit in that state, even a low carb state, but in that state as well as this, you know, increased focus, concentration, etc. But it's also worthwhile noting that some people will struggle, and some struggle mightily. So I think sometimes on the internet we can only read the good stories or the success stories, and sometimes we omit the, you know, the clients that didn't do so well in that strategy. So it's really an individual response.
Right. And, you know, to that note, I've certainly observed this, and you would deal with it with much greater frequency, but how do women differ in terms of intermittent fasting and ketosis? Because I continuously hear feedback that they're like, oh, I tried this ketosis diet and it like legitimately did it. No change in weight, no change in clarity. And I just feel like it's maybe not as effective for a female population.
I think the big difference between men and women, and this is going back to a conference that I was at, evolutionary biologist who I think was just theorizing on this, but if we take it back to even just this idea of as animals, you know, the ultimate goal is to get to the next generation, right? Procreation. So I think, you know, in females, the body's always going to try to conserve this ability. So that's why we, in general, in clinical practice, like you can stick with more restrictive diets for much, much, much longer in men than you can do in women. And so when we get into things like, even if it's a low carb diet, intermittent fasting, a ketogenic diet, you tend to get much better results if you dip your toe into it and then come out of it. And so for certain strategies like a ketogenic diet, you could just go into it for a couple of weeks and then come back out. If you wanted to do more of a day-to-day type thing, depending on, you know, if you're exercising more, you could have some more carbohydrate. On days where you're not training, you could go for more of a low-carb approach. So there's different ways to do it. I think it can be a nice experiment for ketosis to see if people you know, if you really struggle mightily to get into it, then it might tell you something about your blood sugar control and your ability to burn fat. But I don't inherently think it's something that people need to be in all the time. And there's a little bit of evidence to show that, you know, liver function can be impacted if we're in it in a chronic state. So, you know, I think the jury's still out a little bit on this idea of just being in it full stop all year long.
Yeah. And, you know, I would also encourage people too, and I'm sure you'd echo this, like if you really want to get in it and find out how you uniquely optimize this for you, then work with someone who can help you craft a plan that matches your physiological needs.
For sure. And I mean, I always encourage my clients, especially, you know, experiment, see what feels right for you and everything else. I think sometimes when even we do plans and it really didn't feel good, like you mentioned, you might have missed some key bits there or done things perhaps not the best way. Or sometimes you might be right and it's just not the right approach for you. So it's just good to get a second set of eyes to help navigate that. But at the end of the day, yeah, there is this individualized approach. And that's why for me, this ancestral template for nutrition is really just a platform or a starting point. And then after that, it becomes really individualized, whether some people need more grains or lentils or whatever it is that they, or more of a vegetarian diet. Like it depends on the who we're working with, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, one of the notable differences between life back in the day, saber-toothed tiger days, and now is really the amount of stress that we're facing on a day-to-day basis. And there was really a sort of intermittent interface with stress back in ancestral times. And now it seems that from the time we wake up, for some people while they're sleeping, that stress never stops. And I think we both know as clinicians, this affects the adrenal glands. But how do you integrate that component in your practice and with the people that you are working with?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, having worked with some military and people coming back from combat, the stress that we get on the day-to-day is this low-grade stress, but it's a chronic, you know, 24/7 sort of stress. You know, the emails keep coming in, you're checking the Instagram or Twitter or whatever accounts before bed. So this chronic low-grade stress definitely accumulates and has a significant impact. I'd say when we see people who've been in combat or whatnot, they have this overwhelming amount of extremely high acute stress, which has a different response, but also really great in the body. So if we think about the average person with this day-to-day stress, I mean, the brain really gets the big impact, and you know, our adrenal glands, it's not so much adrenal fatigue as it is, you know, it's the brain essentially deciding that we want to keep the adrenals stuck in the mud and sluggish, or all of a sudden the brain's going to decide to ramp up adrenal production and we might feel more of that anxiety, irritability type state. So I think at the end of the day, the brain's still governing everything. But as you mentioned, with technology, that's a real stimulus to the nervous system. So our brains are always getting, you know, much more stimulus throughout the day constantly than they would have done, you know, back in the saber-toothed tiger days, for lack of a better term. And so I think this is one of the reasons why people, all these, you know, anxiety and depression, apparently the World Health Organization says by the year 2050, one third of the planet will have one or the other. And you think to yourself, well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem normal. You know, what's going on in the world around us that's creating this? So I definitely think it's something that's important, and especially amongst the entrepreneur, amongst the type A's, because these are the people who, mentally have good resiliency. So they push through. But once you start running some testing or even, you know, accumulating symptoms, you start to see all these lights on the dashboard of the car that are telling you, you know what, your physiology is working its tail off to keep you going, even though you may say you feel great. And again, that's what you see with athletes. They all tell you they feel fantastic. And that's why you've got to run tests. Otherwise, right, you don't really know, you know, what the fatigue levels are, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, when we worked in South Africa, we would always say that the problems there are very similar to the problems that we would see in a North American or Western context, except there they're really obvious. If someone was deficient in vitamin D, they were developing rickets, and here we catch it on blood work. And that is one of the real advantages of our healthcare system and where we are at, is that we have the technology to determine whether or not there's an issue before we are down that road of pathology. And, you know, to that end, and in looking at things from a functional perspective and not necessarily a reactive perspective, do you have some favorite assessment tools that you like to use with all of your patients?
It always starts with symptoms, number one. I think some easy ones for people is even just how you feel when you wake up in the morning. Do you wake up and your eyes open up nice and you're ready for the day? Or do you wake up and your eyes feel like they don't want to open and you hit snooze a couple times, or you're, you know, desperately looking for your cup of coffee, then that will probably be a subtle sign that you should probably investigate some more testing. If you exercise and it doesn't make you feel better, if you feel tired during or after exercise, that's a big key one as well. And even around sleep, once you start struggling to fall asleep or stay asleep, then those could be some cues for you that things have gone out of whack. And, you know, in clinical practice, again, some low fidelity things, you know, measuring blood pressure, if you start seeing that orthostatic hypotension or just generally low blood pressures, that's one. You can sometimes use a pupillary reflex where you shine the light in the eye and see how long the pupil can constrict for. These are, you know, crude tests, but when you start to accumulate the totality of things, that's when you can decide if you want to get into more of the high fidelity testing, which would be, you know, things like urinary hormones or salivary or blood hormones to really see what's going on with the client.
Right, right. I know. And it really is such a privilege that we can look under the hood, as it were, right? But sometimes having that feedback in terms of like the exercise one, in terms of not feeling better from exercise, it's a great cue for people, right? Because especially this population, they push through.
I think it's a nice one to have alongside even when you're running labs, because that way, if you do, you know, you can always retest labs, but sometimes even as you see the person who really struggled to get out of bed and now 4 or 8 weeks later, they tell you they wake up with their alarm and they feel great. You know, again, that's a rudimentary way of saying, well, the labs are likely getting better and this person's feeling better. So having some things that go along with that are associated with those labs can often be really helpful, because those symptoms for the client anyway are really great ways to, for them, those aha moments of, okay, this is making me feel better. You know, I'm getting better energy, more focus, et cetera.
Yeah. And that's the point, right? Is like the quality of life metric. So yeah, I know it's really, really great. Really great point. I know that lifestyle is so key for you, and you've written about that. That's your background, but do you use supplements? Is there a place for those when you are in an advanced state of ancestral living?
For sure. I mean, I think the whole idea again with the ancestral is really just coming back to eating real food. So, for me, one of the eye openers was, you know, people coming into my office, even who'd seen various practitioners, and all of a sudden there's 8 or 10 bottles of stuff, and you think to yourself, well, wait a minute, we got to get back to a food first approach. But absolutely, there's times to have a targeted and individualized supplement approach. And so for me, a lot of things around nervous system, we just talked about this constant and chronic stress. So supporting the nervous system is a really big one. So, you know, for me, a couple ones that I tend to find myself having to use more and more with various clients. Alpha GPC, so a choline supplement. So choline is interesting because it's a nutrient that's really important for the brain, for the hippocampus area of the brain, which is where we convert short-term to long-term memory. So if you can't remember where you put your phone or what your client's name is, then this could be what's going on. It also helps to set your circadian rhythm, which we've talked about here today. So that's a nice one to have the first thing in the morning. Eggs, the egg yolks is where you get a lot of this naturally. So also you can combine that with getting your egg yolks. And remarkably, like 90% of the population are deficient in choline after the age of 18. So, you know, I think the fear mongering around eggs has scared everybody off of the yolks there.
Yeah, but that's interesting.
That's a really nice one. Ironically, if under 2, it's almost like 90% are good levels. So when we're infants and toddlers, you know, or babies, we feed them the right stuff, and then we sort of forget about ourselves as we get older. So that'd be one. I think another one on that same realm, and this is really nice in endurance athletes, but also just if you're busy and on the run, phosphatidylserine, another nervous system support, you know, taken at bedtime just to help sort of turn the lights off, if you will, of the nervous system. When you get in this fight or flight mode or always on the run, your nervous system is really good at being on. And of course, we know that even in elite athletes, if they can't turn off or relax, then it's a really big stressor on the nervous system, and will drive them into overtraining and feeling run down and low mood and low libido and the rest of it. So this is a nice way, the phosphatidylserine in the evening, you know, do it. You make sure your sleep hygiene after, you know, an hour before bedtime, you start turning the lights down and maybe doing some gentle stretching or take the bath, and definitely put the phone away or the laptop away if you can. If not, then make sure you're using some of the blue light blocking apps or whatnot. But those are just kind of massaging that nervous system, I think, is so important, because as you mentioned, I mean, that low grade stress, especially in the type A and entrepreneurs, is a real fundamental part of kind of disrupting the whole system. So it's amazing how once that gets better, a lot of things tend to fall into place.
Yeah, those habits make such a difference. Mark, is there one thing that you just wish people would ask you and no one ever gets around to that golden nugget or that question or that thing that you're super passionate about?
Well, I wish that people would ask me a lot of things. So I'm not I think women are better at looking into their health or wanting to maintain or optimize health. Whereas I read a medical study saying that men only go to the doctor if they've got a problem with their, if it starts impacting their work life or their sex life. So I think, you know, for the guys out there, if you're then it's time to just, and it's what you do already in your finances. You know, you don't wait until things get into the red to change your investments. And you certainly don't, with a project or business, wait until 65% of it is in the wrong direction before you switch it. But when we talk about health, we tend to just wait and wait and wait until things go in the wrong direction. So I think just getting some metrics and just looking at it as a way to upgrade, you know, how well you think and feel and move, and everything gets better, whether it's work life, home life, definitely.
Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. This month, we are talking about stress and adrenal fatigue. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. These are questions and like rapid fire questions I have for you. You have not seen them before, as if any of this interview we just did, frankly, was remotely close to what I sent you. And I just want your quick response to some of these key performance indicators. So the first one is, what's your morning routine?
Morning routine in the winter times is getting up before the little ones, getting that light box on, bone broth with some collagen in there to kind of prime the system a little bit. And then it's a nice Americano to then kick me into the next gear after that. So that's the morning routine.
Love it. What time do you go to bed?
A lot earlier than I used to. If I can make it to 10, that's sort of a late night.
I hear you. That's a common theme actually with the guests that I've been speaking to. Hot beverage of choice, and how do you prepare it?
Hot beverage of choice. Well, I mean, I think I probably just the bone broth and the coffee are the two, but if we're on a winter theme here, I think if I'm going to relax and decompress and around the festive season there, a good mulled wine is a good way to do it there. Get lots of cinnamon in there. Fantastic.
Nice. And you maybe just answer this for us, but what do you do for fun?
Ironically, I don't do very well with gluten, but I am a big beer fan. So this is, you know, getting a nice stout in again in the wintertime is a good way to decompress. So that would be but nowadays it's more, you know, listening to Dora on the TV, probably with my kids.
I haven't heard that answer yet. It's a good one. And entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do you learn to become an entrepreneur?
This is a great question. And there's an organization called Leaders in Performance that brings together, you know, major league sports and whatnot. And they ask all these experts, is it learned or is it? And it's amazing. They almost seem like they're split down the middle. And I think that in some people, it's definitely probably more of a natural state to be in, and others maybe more of a learned state to be in. But I definitely think it's a combination of both. And that's where things like technology and these kinds of podcasts and everything are great, because it's just a way for people to connect and a way to inspire so many people. So I think I'm totally towing the line on that one. Sorry, but I think it's a little bit of both.
No, it's good. And one last question for you. If you were able to incorporate anything into your house or home that helps to support a healthier lifestyle, what would that be?
Personal chef.
Oh.
That was the, or somebody to do the dishes, but I think I'd pick the personal chef first and then I'd do the dishes afterwards. But definitely, I mean, it's a game changer. You see it with athletes and even a meal delivery service. It's amazing how once that's taken care of, and just think how well people feel when they go, if they go on a holiday for, you know, and all their food taken care of. So definitely for me.
Yeah, that is a good one. You have so much to teach us and so much information. I know people are going to want to find a way to get in touch with you after this interview. Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can check out my writings at drbubs.com. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at drbubs. And you can check out more of the performance leanings on my podcast at drbubs.com/podcast.
Amazing. Mark, as always, it is such a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Awesome, Meg. Thanks so much for having me.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Anthropology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.